Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Affney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A very, very critical battle in that war is underway on the home front at the moment. It is the battle to preserve and, in fact, assure the future availability of free and fair elections in America. It is taking the form of a legislative slugfest that will be playing out in the next few hours on the floor of the United States Senate. It is about a piece of legislation that has come to be known as the Corrupt Politicians Act. Its formal title is the For the People Act. It was called H.R. 1 in the House. It is S.1 in the Senate. Or maybe it's not. We're going to find out exactly what is going on in the Senate at the moment and why, with one of the country's preeminent experts on this subject and many others. Her name is Jessica Anderson. She is the executive director of a terrific organization in Washington, D.C., Heritage Action for America. She is responsible for, among other things, the very concerted effort that Heritage Action is leading in what they call Save Our Elections. And I think you can find out a lot more about it, not only from what you're going to hear from Jessica in these segments, but also in her website, saveourelections.org. Jessica Anderson, it is so good to have you back. I know how frantically busy you are at the moment because all of this is coming to a head within the next day or so. Thank you for joining us at Secure Freedom Radio once again. It's great to have you with us.
Frank, it's great to be here with you today. Thanks for having me.
Good. Listen, I want to start, if I can, with you talking a little bit about how we got to this point, specifically the 2020 election cycle. A lot of focus, of course, on the presidential contest, but it would seem as though some of the problems that afflicted the Trump versus Biden race also mattered down ballot as well. And I thought maybe we might just start with what is going on in Arizona at the moment in terms of the forensic audit there and what it's suggesting. The conclusions are not yet released, of course, but what it's suggesting from what we've seen so far about various techniques that seem to have compromised that election last year.
So what's interesting, Frank, is that after the November 2020 election, we all kind of have looked at that day to try to understand exactly what happened and why. The why matters just as much as the what. And part of the chaos around election 2020 was brought on by these COVID convenience laws that circumvented and went around state legislators. They went around state laws and they were put into place by very, in some cases, corrupt. I don't think we should shy away from saying what it was. In some cases, corrupt local officials trying to take advantage of the COVID lockdowns and crisis at the time to create laws that put into doubt the vote, put into doubt the security and the sanctity of the ballot box. And so as these audits are happening throughout the country, Arizona obviously being top of mind, they're working on some of this in states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Fulton County, Georgia. I think you're going to start to see these trend lines where you have abuses of those COVID convenience laws that then gave way to fraud, and it gave way, certainly gave way to election observers that were cut out from actually watching the chain of custody, watching the ballot counting. And you add that, you add the chaos of November on top of the vulnerabilities that already existed in state laws around the accuracy of voter registration lists, around some states requiring voter ID, others not, around how you request an absentee ballot, whether it's from a request form or it's automatically sent. Are there any security watermarks or provisions on the absentee, the time periods for early voting, the placement of drop boxes. I mean, it's a whole list of items that are in state law, and whether or not that law was followed or if a corrupt official tried to circumvent the election law in place and used COVID as the distraction or the excuse. So all of that is in the backdrop of these audits. And as each of these audits go forward, I think you're going to get, again, continue to see more of the what and more of the why over what happened in November.
That's a terrific overview. Let me drill down on a couple of things that you said. We've seen in the last election cycle, again, I think you call them COVID convenience laws, this effort to proliferate massively the use, not of absentee ballots, but just simply mail-in ballots. Talk a little bit, Jessica, about our experience with that. Going back, I think it was to, 2001, when Jimmy Carter and Jim Baker on a bipartisan electoral reform commission warned vigorously against this idea of using mail-in ballots. And talk a little bit about why they did.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the Carter-Baker commission, because that was bipartisan. I mean, of course, that was a number of years ago now, but that had bipartisan support. So from a Democrat and Republican perspective, you had agreement that things like mail-in ballots that didn't have security provisions and that weren't directly attached to voter registration lists and then cross-coordinated across the different agencies within a state government that are in charge of those voter registration lists, that then could give way to fraud. It could give way to bad and malicious actors that were trying to steal the election. And so, you know, it's interesting historically, because everyone agreed to that then. But then you fast forward to 2021 and 2022, and all of a sudden it becomes this fiercely partisan and divisive conversation around mail-in ballots. And I think the conservative perspective on this needs to be made very, very clear. We're not saying that mail-in ballots shouldn't exist. We're not saying they should be outlawed. Of course, there are reasonable expectations to use an absentee ballot, like if you are a student and you're not in your home, you're not at your home to vote, you're away at college, or if you're part of our armed forces and you're deployed, or if you're moving, you know, you're relocating state to state, but your residency stays there. So, or a disabled elderly. I mean, those were the original intent when absentee mail-in ballots came onto the scene. The problem now is that they are being sent out without any legitimate cause or reason, and they're not deduplicated against voter registration lists versus if you're voting in person or how many ballots you're sent. People have been sent upwards of three different ballots to the same address. And so that sort of chaotic housekeeping breeds more and more chaos, which then lays the seed or the groundwork for the type of fraud that should worry all Americans. But I do think, you know, not to belabor the point, but it is important that we go back to the principles. What was the original intent of an absentee mail-in ballot? Where are we today? Well, we are light years away from that. And the Bipartisan Voting Commission from, you know, a decade and a half ago was right to call out the concerns of fraud. We're right to call it out today. And I certainly applaud states like Arizona and Georgia and Iowa and Florida that are trying to right those wrongs so we can get back to the original intent of what an absentee ballot is used for and how to use it in an election.
Again, I think that's an elegant presentation of the arguments against doing this. We're going to come back to why that matters so much. But before we do, just one other point on this. You touched on this again, Jessica Anderson. What is it that causes people to believe that we don't need to identify voters like we do people who have bank accounts or who are collecting, you know, welfare payments or entering federal buildings or any number of things? This being so important, this civic duty of ours, it would seem a no-brainer. And I gather from public opinion surveys that the vast majority of Americans think it is a no-brainer to have voter ID laws. We didn't see it in many of these states. And again, this is a present question as well. But talk about the logic of foregoing that and what it does in practice in terms of inviting fraud in elections.
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought up voter ID. You know, it's something that consistently polls nationwide. Over 85% to 95% of Americans support it. And I think part of the reason for the support is not only the trust and veracity at the ballot box, but it's also because voter ID is such a a part of our daily life already. I mean, I use an ID to get on an airplane, to buy wine. In the state of Maryland where I live, we use an ID to go to MLB baseball games, pick up our tickets from the will call. You use an ID for concerts. You use an ID to get into federal buildings. So it is certainly part of our day-to-day interactions already. So why would we not want voter ID at the most sacred part of our American institutions, which is the ballot box, to be able to vote, to be able to prove you are who you are when you show up to vote that day? And so critics of voter ID, they have a mission in mind, which is they want ineligible and oftentimes illegal voters to vote. And the best way to allow an influx of ineligible voters is to not have any safeguards tell you if they are who they say they are. And that's why they're critiquing so much of voter ID, because they want to be able to bring in new swaths of voters that are ineligible with the goal of rigging that election for the progressive cause. You know, if HR 1 passes, then certainly for the rest of my generation. If it doesn't, then we'll see how it goes state by state.
Yeah. And this brings us to where I needed to go next, main topic of today, which is we're seeing these kinds of arrangements proposed as part of permanent national federal law in this bill, H.R. 1 S1. What is the motivation for that, to put a fine point on it?
Well, I think the progressive left is actually surprisingly been pretty clear about what their motivation is. AOC, the founding and leading member of the Democrats squad, as we know they call themselves, came out and point blank said last week that the purpose of HR 1 is that Democrats don't have to fight for another election ever again and that they will just win them. And, you know, she said the quiet part out loud. You got to hand it to her. She was just very clear about what the whole purpose is. And we've been since January that HR 1 is an attempt to have a complete federal overtake of the entire country's election systems at the state and local levels and have a one-size-fits-all election process and program that ultimately rigs the election so that progressive Democrats will win every forthcoming election afterwards. And part of it gets at what we were just talking about, where it would eliminate voter ID laws, where they actually write in the bill a whole, like, multiple section, a whole bunch of lines around ineligible voters and the pathway for illegal aliens to actually be able to vote in our elections. They write it out very clearly that there wouldn't be any prohibitions disallowing illegal immigrants and illegal aliens to vote in our elections. So you could come to the country illegally on a Friday and vote on a Tuesday under the new regime that HR 1 would create for our federal election system. That is concerning, and that is their goal. They cannot win on the policies alone. They resort to tactics like this. And this is exactly why I think we've seen such an outpouring of activism and frustration from grassroots activists and leaders across the country, because they're saying no, and they're stepping up and fighting back and saying, we don't want to see our elections overcome. We want to keep ballot security, and we want to keep the sanctity of our vote in place when we go to the ballot box in November.
So, Jessica, this brings us to the state of play in the Senate at the moment. There's a lot, it seems, of high drama. The stakes being as high as they are, it'd be surprising if there weren't. A lot of it is turning on a senator from West Virginia by the name of Joe Manchin. Tell us about his position on this legislation and what both he and the Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, are doing to try to engineer the approval of some kind of election reform legislation, and quite possibly one that has many of the very adverse and really insidious aspects that you've just described.
So Senator Manchin of West Virginia often finds himself in a pickle like this, where he is trying to appease the West Virginia voters back home that are more moderate. Some even are right of center. They're very reasonable, God-loving, country-loving West Virginians, right? that want to see Manchin uphold things like the Senate filibuster and oppose the federal overtake of our elections with S1.
You say appease. It seems to me a better word for it would be represent the people of his state.
That represent. That's exactly right. Represent West Virginians. But then he wants to appease those on his other shoulder, which is the far left progressive agenda of his party. And unfortunately, for Manchin, the Democrat Party is moving further and further and further to the left. And on this issue of S1, they have done it in a way that is most revealing to their aims, as we just talked about, with the goal of S1. And so Manchin has come out and he has said that he still supports the filibuster. And he has said that he wants a series of changes to S1. Now, the press is running with this and they're framing it as Manchin's compromise. And so the best way I know how to describe this is political theater. There's not really a process that would allow Manchin's quote unquote compromise bill or legislative package to actually be taken up in the Senate this week because they don't have the vote on the motion to proceed. So the state of play of where we are now is Senator Schumer has filed cloture on Senate Bill 1, which is the amended bill from what went through the committee. So he exercised something called Rule 14, and I don't want to get too wonky here, but he took the bill that was supposed to have been discharged from the committee, and instead of having a vote on that discharge vote, he exercised Rule 14, which then substituted S1 with that committee bill plus the manager's package. So there actually were a couple of changes there. They're not substantive, but it's a whole new bill with the same principles of S1 before.
So this is a little wonky, I have to say, and I might have lost you myself, let alone our audience. But Jessica, I guess basically what you've said is Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, has used his authority to try to figure out a way to accommodate Senator Manchin to some extent while preserving most of what's wrong with S1. And somehow thereby get to the requisite number of votes for this legislation. Have I got that about right?
That's about right. The clincher is the Manchin bill or the Manchin set of compromises that he wants to see in the bill, they don't exist yet. And that's why it's theater, because it actually isn't being put into the package that will be voted on Tuesday. So instead, what you're seeing is Schumer saying, Senator Manchin, thank you for your edits and suggestions. We'll take them under consideration. But he doesn't actually take those elements and change S1 at all. And that's because of the way the procedure is in place. So instead, the motion to proceed, which is the Tuesday vote in the Senate, it will fail. It will fail because it has to get to 60 and there's not enough votes to get to 60. So this is all about political theater to keep Manchin happy, with the goal that as soon as the S1 motion to proceed vote fails on Tuesday, they will quickly pivot then and say, Republicans are obstructionists. They continue to not allow, you know, a landmark voting rights bill to move forward. They are racist. They're vote suppressors. This is Jim Crow 2.0. I mean, the narrative, Frank, we know the narrative. It's already been written, right? The press headlines for later this week, they've already been written. And so it's then just a matter of, okay, we've tried to placate Manchin, and now we want to drive that support into a second bill, which could come up later this summer, called H.R. 4. This is the Voting Rights Act, and this is what is currently being redrafted because, I kid you not, because parts of it are unconstitutional. Nancy Pelosi said so herself. They're redrafting it. And if I had to guess, they will take parts of S1 from the exercise this week. They will take some of Manchin's suggestions and they will repackage it all under H.R. 4. And then we're back right to the drawing board. Is there enough to nuke the filibuster to move this bill forward? And as long as senators hold their support for the filibuster, then these bills are essentially stalled on the runway. But that support is critical, and it's the only way we will keep and save our election.
Jessica, thank you for, you know, sort of laying this out so clearly. And really, I guess the question that we've been encouraged to believe is imminent, though, is will Senator Manchin depart from his promises to his constituents and faithfully representing them as supporters of the filibuster and go with a nuking of it, as you put it, that will enable perhaps just a 51 vote majority to enact these very problematic pieces of legislation, whether it's S1 in one variation or another, or what you say is previously been called at least HR4.
That's exactly right. And so the filibuster becomes, you know, it's a Senate procedure. It feels out of touch to the grassroots, but it really becomes the nexus by which the left then can have an open door or open the floodgates to any other sorts of policies, everything from packing the Supreme Court to abolishing the Second Amendment, defunding the police, further encroachment of Obamacare, all of these other policies that don't have the votes in the Senate. If the filibuster goes, all of that is free for all. It's a free game. And so that's why you see the S1 conversation becoming so energized from the conservatives, but then polarizing because the left is trying to drive this narrative to get rid of the filibuster, to pass S1, and then they can do all of these other things afterwards.
Jessica Anderson, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your visiting with us and laying out this information. It is vital that all of us understand what's afoot and engage. And I want to commend you. I was at the Western Conservative Summit this weekend and saw the Heritage Action team there briefing people, getting individuals and groups, for that matter, both up to speed and actually engaging in this very important public policy debate. And I really salute you for your work. Remind everybody how they can find out more about it and participate in it.
Visit saveourelections.com for everything I just outlined, as well as the fights at the state and local level as well. And thank you, Frank, for having me. This is fabulous.
Well, the pleasure is mine. Let me just repeat, saveourelections.com. is the go-to resource, and I encourage everybody to do that. I certainly will. Thank you, Jessica. Come back to us again with updates very soon, if you would. We appreciate you so much. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about the latest developments in China. You're not going to want to miss this. There's a lot right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm very pleased to say we're joined by one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, one of our country's preeminent authorities on matters involving communist China, and particularly the unrestricted warfare that it has been waging against this country for, well, decades. His name is Gordon Chang. He is the author of The Coming Collapse of China, topical book at the moment, as we'll be discussing, as well as The Great U.S.-China Tech War. He contributes prolifically to the public policy debate, notably on platforms like the Gatestone Institute and Newsweek. And, of course, you can follow him, as I do, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. It's great to have you back, Gordon. Welcome.
Well, it's great to be here, Frank, so thank you.
There is a big story, and I'm not sure what to make of it myself, but I'm anxious to get your thoughts about it, involving the reported defection of a very senior Chinese Communist Party figure by the name of Dong Jingwei. We've had the Chinese vociferously deny this is so, and others saying as much. And yet there do seem to be some signs that something really momentous has happened here. Tell us what you make of the rumors or the reports or the wishful thinking, perhaps, and what, if it's true, it would portend.
There are rumors that Dong Jingwei, who was a vice minister of state security at the Ministry of State Security, has defected to the United States. He did that apparently in the beginning of February, along with his daughter. He is talking to the Defense Intelligence Agency, which actually in the beginning did not share this news with other intelligence agencies in the U.S. for fear that they were compromised based upon information from Dong. As you point out, Beijing believes and states that Dong has not defected. Beijing Daily and Hong Kong South China Morning Post have both published stories talking about Dong still in China. But I believe that these reports are credible. And the reason is Beijing could end this controversy once and for all by trotting him out in public. And that would be the end of it. And Beijing has every reason to trot him out in public if they have him. And that's because his defection has triggered intense speculation about infighting at the top of the Communist Party. And Beijing would not want that type of conversation, both in and outside China, to continue. So the fact that they have not shown him is a real indication that the Defense Intelligence Agency does have him. Now, the Communist Party is based on struggle. It idealizes struggle. And there have been analyses of Chinese Communist Party propaganda over the last, let's say, 6 weeks, 2 months, showing hints of real factional struggle. Now, the party is always, as I mentioned, you know, based on struggle, always has a lot of discord at the top, but this is more than usual. And so when the news of the defection of Dong Jingwei hit, it seemed to validate that reporting. This is momentous because this could lead to an unraveling of the People's Republic of China. We don't know what will happen, of course, but it's not impossible that the regime falls apart in fairly quick order, because Dong is supposed, he was China's top counterintelligence official, knows all the secrets, many of the secrets, and was close to Xi Jinping. And that would mean Xi Jinping is not as strong as he appears. One other thing, Frank, the reporting is that Dong has brought evidence that the Chinese military was involved in conducting research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. If true, that is extremely, that is explosive.
Well, it seems increasingly clear that that is so. It would be fantastic if we actually had confirmation of it. Gordon, one other thing that a guy who was in charge of counterintelligence for the Chinese Communist Party would bring to the Defense Intelligence Agency or others in the U.S. government would be, of course, insights into the degree to which the Chinese have compromised our country and its leadership. And there is concern about that in connection, among other things. John Ratcliffe, the former director of Central of National Intelligence, said over the weekend that he considers the president and the national security advisor to the president, Jake Sullivan, and the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Bill Burns, to have all been possibly compromised by their business dealings or other relations with the Chinese Communist Party over the years. These are the sorts of things that could be quite explosive inside Washington, not just inside Communist China.
Yes. Well, first of all, because Dong was China's top counterintelligence official, he will know about the compromise of the CIA in China. And this has led to the execution of CIA agents, about 30 of them or so. So he's been quite effective in this. He can tell us a lot about that. I suspect, as you point out, he can tell us a lot about China's spies in the U.S. and its agents, and about relationships that American officials have had with China. So all of this is going to be out, and it is going, as you say, to be explosive here as well. So this will change. It certainly will change China and could very well change us. And it's going to lead to a very different relationship, because one thing that could happen, Frank, is that if Ratcliffe is correct, it would mean that the officials that he mentions could very well no longer be of use to China because the information is out in the public, which means that they'd have to take a harder line on China in order to protect their positions in the U.S. So this would be good news, of course, and it could very well change the course of even our posture towards China and certainly China's posture toward us.
Well, it can't come too soon if it is true that those kinds of course corrections take place. Let me just give you a couple of examples, Gordon, that I'd like to get your thoughts on. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor of the President, over the weekend was sort of talking down this whole idea that there was going to be any real pressure brought to bear on China with respect to the Wuhan virus. The concern is that if we don't press hard, we may persist, unless this fellow Dong is actually in our hands, in uncertainty about the full nature and ultimate objectives of the Chinese Communist Party with respect to this Wuhan virus. Give us your sense as to the advisability of easing up, as the Biden administration seems to be, perhaps for the reasons John Ratcliffe has mentioned. But for example, we've been told that there was a 200-page report about all of this that is now been produced by the Biden administration, and it does not mention at all the question of the origins of this disease and the pandemic that flowed from it. What do we make of all of that?
Well, first of all, we know that this must flow from the top, because Biden did have that two-hour phone call with Xi Jinping in February, and Biden's own admission is he didn't raise the issue of the coronavirus. You know, Biden does not want to talk about this because that would cause a rupture in the relationship with Beijing. And Biden believes he needs China's help on at least two projects. One of them, of course, is climate change. The other is the nuclear discussions with Iran, which are now ongoing. So because he needs help on the nuke talks at this moment and climate change in general, he does not want to severely disrupt the relationship with China. When Jake Sullivan talked on the news shows yesterday, he was basically saying, look, we need the help of our allies, and we are trying to bring them on board. Theoretically, that sounds nice, but what that means in practice is accepting lowest common denominator solutions. And we know that that process, with regard to China and with other regimes, doesn't work. And also what Sullivan was talking about, in effect, meant delay. And every time we delay, more Americans die. Remember on May 26, Biden talked about, he ordered the intelligence agencies to come back in 90 days. Really, what he should be doing is declassifying the intelligence. And now with these revelations about Dong Zhengwei, there's going to be more pressure on him to do that. And indeed, the report that comes back on August 24th is going to have to take into account the information that Dong has presumably given to the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Be tracking this very closely, as I know will you, Gordon, and we look forward to further updates on it. Let me ask you about another story that is also in the news that is very worrying. The further crackdown in Hong Kong by Xi Jinping's regime, and specifically the arrest and, well, the seizure of a lot of equipment and disruption of Apple Daily, the most popular paper in Hong Kong and a pro-democracy paper founded by Jimmy Lai, who was arrested and is now serving a long prison sentence for having been a voice for democracy, having stood up to the Chinese Communist Party. It seems several of his editors are now going to be thrown into the same prison system that he's in. And yet the Biden administration is talking about having a summit with Xi Jinping. These would seem to be the kinds of events that argue for, well, what you've been calling for assiduously, Gordon, to your great credit, namely distancing ourselves from China, disengaging from it, and certainly an end to the enabling of the repression at home and the aggression abroad that increasingly characterizes Xi Jinping's regime.
Taking your last point first, China is committing genocide and crimes against humanity against Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other Turkic minorities, as well as the Tibetans. And just to run through this, it's detained at least more than a million in facilities that meet the definition of concentration camps. We know that people are being brutalized in those camps. They're dying because China's building crematoria next to them. There is institutionalization of slavery, institutionalization of rape, probably forced organ harvesting. We know children have been detained in facilities that look like prisons. This is horrific. And so when Ned Price is a State Department spokesman, and Jake Sullivan talk about principled diplomacy, if you have any principles, you wouldn't have any diplomacy with a regime like this. With regard to Hong Kong, and this is increasingly important to us, on Thursday, more than 500 police officers invaded the offices of Apple Daily and Next Digital, the publisher of the newspaper, arrested the CEO of Next Digital, the editor-in-chief of Apple Daily, and staff at Apple Daily. What they're doing is freezing bank accounts, which means that people that the paper may not be able to publish too much longer. But the people of Hong Kong are resisting. They're lining up at newsstands to buy copies of Apple Daily to support the paper. What is missing is what you point out. That's the Biden administration. When Biden was running for president, he said he was going to be the human rights president. And in that vein, he was criticizing then President Trump. And he was saying that he was going to do something about it. Well, now's the time for him to do something about it because Apple Daily is in mortal danger. And Biden's silence is deafening.
It is. As is the failure to take steps that would punish. I mean, it's not just that he's sort of sitting idly by. It's in effect, he's rewarding the Chinese Communist Party for this kind of behavior by, well, not only the prospect of a summit with them, but also, you know, the persistent refusal, it seems, to decouple the U.S. dollar from the Hong Kong dollar, which I'm told would have a very profound effect on China and its access to, you know, the international capital markets and the like. And of course, you know, the continued, plan to go forward with the U.S. participation in the genocide games in communist China in February of next year. And these are the sorts of things that can only be seen as flashing green lights to a thug like Xi Jinping, I'm afraid. Gordon, let me switch gears a little bit if I can. One of the things that we have been hearing about is Chinese efforts to propagandize in our country on a unprecedented scale, I think it's fair to say. And this is not just their formal media outlets, but their use of what sounds a lot like a kind of thousand talents plan, which they use to recruit scientists and, you know, others with technical skills and expertise that they were interested in having help the Chinese Communist Party, its People's Liberation Army, and of course, its economy. This involves, however, recruiting large numbers of influencers in the West who would be paid a stipend to essentially help legitimate and disseminate Chinese propaganda. What do we know about this operation and how does it fit into the larger sort of information warfare that is part and parcel of the unrestricted warfare the Chinese pursue against us?
Well, Beijing, more than any other regime, attempts to use political warfare against the United States. And we saw that last year in connection with the coronavirus, in connection with Black Lives Matter and Antifa protests. What Beijing is doing from scattered reports is actually, as you say, trying to go to people who are influential in the United States and to actually recruit them. I don't know how accurate these reports are. I suspect that, though, this is the thing that Beijing tries to do, because we do have some very influential people in the U.S. who have been parroting Communist Party narratives. So, for instance, Jeffrey Sachs has been basically issuing reports, statements, tweets, which are indistinguishable from that which from Beijing. So I don't know if China is paying Jeffrey Sachs. They very well may not have to. But the point is that they do identify Americans who will propagate their narratives. And we're seeing this on a more organized basis. So I believe that in general, these reports are accurate. And this goes, this is a worldwide campaign. We're not
Absolutely.
The only
no, that's right.
targets of this. But clearly, we are seeing a level of penetration which is approximating that of Canada. I mean, Canada, by
which
the way,
a lot.
You know, we think is a lot because we think of Canada as being our ally, being our closest neighbor. Actually, the government of Justin Trudeau is much closer to Beijing than it is to Washington.
It's a staggering statement, but I know it to be true, Gordon, and it's very profoundly worrying because of the security implications of such an arrangement. Let me turn to one other topic that I know is looming, and that is the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party. It is hardly a moment for celebration, I think, for, well, probably many Chinese, as well as the rest of us. It seems as though the Chinese government is exceedingly concerned that something might be done that would mar, shall we say, what they intend to have be an exhibition of the power and the authority of the Chinese Communist Party. Gordon, what are we to make of this anniversary, and how should we, in what's left of the free world, mark it?
Well, for instance, July 1st is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party of China. And there have been for months now a lot of propaganda pieces on this. Clearly, there's going to be a culmination on the 1st. And with every event in China of any significance, Beijing is extremely concerned about security. And we see this most graphically every year at the meeting of the National People's Congress, usually in early March. But they're going to go full time on this. The other thing, though, in this
and
relates
let me to just say the techniques that they're bringing to bear to enforce control, the social credit score system and the surveillance state apparatus and just massive police presence and screening of individuals seems to be taking place on truly an unprecedented scale at the moment.
Yeah, China is, people call China authoritarian. I think that is an outdated label. I don't believe China is totalitarian, but Xi Jinping is moving the country to totalitarianism. And I think that you can say that China is semi-totalitarian now. We talk about the social credit systems, which are being knitted together into a nationwide one. The surveillance mechanisms, 626 million surveillance cameras, they claim. The Great Firewall, the world's most sophisticated set of internet controls, and all of what they're doing. So China is moving very fast back to something that Mao Zedong would be familiar with. And this really relates to something we started out with, and that is the defection of Dong Jingwei. The fact that he got out with his daughter, according to these reports, if they're true, means that they're going to be and already have been locking down China even more. And it very well may not be related to the 100th anniversary celebration, but very well may be related to preventing other officials from leaving, because there is concern, and you hear this among China watchers, that they are trying to prevent officials from actually leaving the People's Republic. There's a tightened control on money flows. So this whole society is going towards lockdown. Yes, part of it is the 100th anniversary celebration, but I think it's a real concern that the regime might come apart.
Gordon, one other of the projects that the Chinese Communist Party has been pursuing very aggressively, including through theft of technology and other techniques designed to essentially advance, if I could use the expression, a great leap forward, a space program for China. In the past few days, the first Chinese astronauts have entered the space station that the Chinese have put together in recent months. Talk a little bit with us about the implications of what China is doing in space, on the space station and more broadly, and what it will mean for our country, our security, as well as our commercial interests, if they succeed.
Well, China's space program is a military program, and there are two elements to the space station that are extreme concern to the United States. One of them is that it has a laser. The Chinese say they're using this laser to zap space junk that would threaten the station. But it could also be used to zap satellites that are nearby, which basically are ours. So our assets in low Earth orbit are at risk. Also, there is some talk that this space station will have a net, and that will be used to grabbing satellites for repair. Well, it could also be used to knock satellites out of orbit or to actually capture our satellites. So as the Chinese space station grows, I think it has two modules now that have been joined together. But as they put additional modules on, as get more capabilities, we've got to be concerned that we could be blinded in space because of, among other things, this space station.
And as you say, this is only part of a much more comprehensive program involving colonizing the moon and dominating key locations in space from which power can be projected. There's talk of lasers as well as various missile capabilities. And Gordon, I guess the point you've made is really the right one, that we're talking about an inherently military project. It will have profound implications for our national security, but also, I believe, for our economic well-being, given the dependency of so much of our commercial enterprises on space and our free use thereof. So this is, again, another area where the true threat of the Chinese Communist Party needs to be very carefully calibrated. Gordon, let me ask you lastly. We had in our own country a very important statement made, so a couple of different forums, by a woman by the name of Zhi Van Fleet, who was a survivor as a child of, you spoke of Mao Zedong, one of his most horrific crimes against humanity, namely the Cultural Revolution. And she warned that what we're seeing happening in our own country, specifically the use of sort of race conflict or proselytizing, racist training, if you will, as really right out of the playbook of the class warfare, class struggle, cultural revolution techniques of Mao. Very quickly, we've only got a minute and a half left, but what are your thoughts about the danger that some of these practices are now beginning to manifest themselves in our own country?
Yeah, there have been a number of people from North Korea and China who have commented recently that the wokeness does look like either the North Korean campaigns. There was a story about Columbia University being worse than North Korea, and Van Fleet's comments. What China did during the Cultural Revolution and before and after really was class-based. What we're hearing now is race-based, but as been pointed out, the techniques are the same. Yes, this is the Cultural Revolution is coming to the United States. And we've got to do everything possible immediately to stop this, because that tore apart China. The People's Republic almost fell apart during the Cultural Revolution, which was a decade-long campaign. And although we tend to think of the United States as being stable and secure, all societies are fragile. So, yes.
We're watching that at the moment. I'm not sure I agree with your characterization of China as not quite totalitarian yet, or that the cultural revolution is coming to America. I fear that both are more or less accomplished facts, and we've got to be alive to them. You're absolutely right about that, for sure. Thank you for your time today, my friend, and your insights on so many of these really important issues. We're delighted to have a chance to visit with you at length about them. Thank you for doing so. We'll come back to you, I hope, next week. I hope the rest of you, though, will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
The U.S. Constitution went into effect this day, June 21st, 1788, when the ninth state ratified it. Of those who wrote the Constitution, 29 were Episcopalian, 9 Presbyterian, 7 Congregationalists, 2 Lutheran, 2 Dutch Reformed, 2 Methodist, two Roman Catholic, one Quaker, and one open deist, Dr. Benjamin Franklin, who stated, "We have been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord build a house, they labor in vain. I believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.
This is Fred Flights, president of the Center for Security Policy, and I'm here to announce an important new center book, Defending Against Biothreats: What We Can Learn from the Coronavirus Pandemic to Enhance U.S. Defenses Against Pandemics and Biological Weapons. The center assembled 11 outstanding experts to do this book, including China expert Gordon Chang and former Soviet biological weapons scientist Ken Allebeck. This book looks at U.S. biodefenses, why they desperately need to be improved, and what America's enemies learned from this pandemic to stage future bioattacks against our country. Defending Against Biothreats is available right now from Amazon.com. You also can read about the book and watch the Center's new biosecurity webinar series on the Center's website,